to today's guest, Jonathan Shanzer. Jonathan has served as a counterterrorism analyst at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. He was also a research fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He is currently the vice chairman of the policy committee of the Committee on the Present Danger. Mr. Shanzer has authored the book, Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups, and The Next Generation of Terror. He is director of policy at the Jewish Policy Center, headquartered in Washington, D.C. Jonathan Shanzer, welcome to the Justice Hour.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Today, we'll discuss one aspect of the most intractable political problem of our modern times, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Your book, as the title, Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine, boldly states, analyzes the relationship between the two main rival factions of the Palestinian people. It's the backdrop of more than the 61-year-old state of Israel and its beginnings, the Near East's endless wars and countless violent acts between all the players involved. It's imperative for us to first review the history of the bloody awful situation in the Holy Land. The second part of today's program will speak directly about those things that have caused the fitna, the Arab word for internal struggle. And lastly, we'll attempt to put the struggle for Palestine in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and perhaps the broader issues of that troubled corner of the world. Jonathan, why is it important for Americans, who are probably as tired as anyone of hearing about the Palestinian-Israeli situation, to know who these actors, Hamas and Fatah, are?
Well, it comes down to one very simple fact. Right now, we're hearing from the U.S. Administration, the Obama administration, we're hearing from the United Nations and the EU, really the entire world, there's a chorus right now for getting the Palestinians and Israelis back to the peace table, that we need to jumpstart negotiations and that this is an imperative. Well, what my book looks at and what I think is very important is that there is actually a civil war that is taking place within the Palestinian Authority. You've got Hamas on one side, you've got Fatah on the other. Hamas is an Islamic fundamentalist organization. Fatah is is more of a socialist, secular organization, but is also rooted in terrorism. These two organizations are fighting each other openly in the streets and exchanging barbs, and politically they're just not able to figure out how to get along so that they can essentially govern the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So while this is happening, it becomes very clear to observers in the Middle East, those who are actually following this, that there is really no way to get back to the negotiating table at this time. And this is not a positive development. I mean, it's important to note. But the fact that we've got these two Palestinian factions that are fighting one another means that we don't know who the interlocutor is on the Palestinian side of things. We know who would come to the table from the Israeli side. We have a new prime minister in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. He would represent the Israelis in negotiations, but we don't know who would represent the Palestinians. Would it be Fatah or would it be Hamas? Right now, given the fact that the two Palestinian territories are split between these two factions, it becomes almost impossible to return to the negotiating table at this point.
So really it's a matter of national security for the United States.
Well, it is to the extent that people believe that the Arab-Israeli conflict will ultimately, you know, that its solution will ultimately provide security for the United States. In other words, you know, a lot of complaints from the Islamist camp, those who carry out terrorist attacks or vilify the United States, will say that the largest problem and the biggest beef they have with the United States right now is the fact that the Arab-Israeli conflict continues. So if you buy into that logic, then what we really need to see before anything else happens is peace between the two Palestinian factions. And there have been multiple attempts since January to bring the two sides together in Egypt. There have been reconciliation talks that continue to be held and continue to fail. And so it is, in that sense, a security issue for the United States.
Now, the history, as many people may not know, goes back to before the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Firstly, when did the first manifestations of violence between Jews and Palestinians occur?
Well, there have been a series of uprisings, most notably in the late 1920s and early 1930s. This was called the Arab Revolt, and this was fanned by the Mufti, the religious authority of the Palestinians, who, by the way, was an uncle to Yasser Arafat. He essentially sparked fear into the hearts of the Palestinians, saying that the Jews who had immigrated to what was then Palestine were interested in taking over Muslim holy sites and essentially taking all of the land from the Palestinians. This was ultimately not the case, as we saw in 1948 when Israel agreed to a partition plan between the Palestinians, or the local Arabs, let's say, and the Jews. The Arab population, the Palestinian population, rejected this in favor of violence.
Now, was there a power struggle between Palestinian people at that time?
There was. During the, I would say, the 1930s and 1940s, there were two powerful factions. One was the Husseini clan, and the other one was the Nashashibi clan. Now, Arab politics is always dominated by family and tribe and other sorts of allegiances along those lines, and it was at that point where these two families squared off. The Husseini clan was a little bit more hardline, didn't want to compromise at all with the Israelis. You had the other family that was saying, well, let's work with the Israelis. At the end of the day, the radical camp won out.
Now, what was the situation of the British Mandate in Palestine and Transjordan before World War II?
Well, you had, before World War II, the entire area that we now see as West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, and Israel itself were all under the control of the of the British Empire. This was the country of Transjordan and the Palestinian Mandate. And by 1948, the Brits decided that they were going to relinquish control of Israel and that the mandate would be handed over to the international community. And it was at that point that the international community determined that they would partition Palestine into two parts, one that would be called Israel and one that would be called Palestine for the Palestinian people. And again, that proposal was rejected, leading to the 1948-49 War of Independence. And it really shocked a lot of people that Israel, which was really then a nation of about 600,000 people, was able to repel the invading Arab armies, five armies. And so it was a sort of a miraculous military victory and set things in motion to what we see today.
Why was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem such a central figure in the relationship between Jews and the Palestinians?
Well, the Grand Mufti was a radicalizing, polarizing figure. This was a man. There's a great book called Icon of Evil, which came out this past year on the Mufti's relationship with Hitler. And essentially, the Mufti determined that he was going to side with the Axis powers during World War II, and in exchange for his help, he would be promised an Islamic State of Palestine. And so essentially he did all that he could to radicalize the Palestinian population, you know, in his war against Israel. And I think had it not been for him, there's a chance, I don't know how good, but there's a chance that things would have worked out a little differently, maybe a little bit more of a peaceful situation.
After the war, why were the prospects so poor for a mutually agreeable solution for nationhood for both the Jews and the Palestinians?
After the partition plan, let's put it this way. The Arab states had really no interest in allowing a state of Palestine to exist. After the 1948 war, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the areas that are now considered the Palestinian territories, were actually under the control of the Arab state. The Gaza Strip was under the control of Egypt. The West Bank was under the control of Jordan. And they did not hand over these territories to the Palestinians. As a matter of fact, in the Gaza Strip, a small government building was established on behalf of the Palestinian people. It was called the All Government of Palestine, and they raised the Palestinian flag over this building, and the Egyptians tore it down. The Egyptians essentially denied the Palestinians the statehood that they sought, even in those two territories. And it only was until, you know, the Israelis conquered these territories in 1967 that they began to talk about them as Palestinian. Before that, they were really, you know, Arab territories, conquests. So the Arab states, I would argue, had a great deal to do with prevention of a Palestinian state, particularly from 1948 to 1967. And I could also even add that even today, the Arab states play a role in exacerbating the Arab-Israeli conflict. In other words, they will weigh in on various peace deals and reject certain offers, and it makes things much more difficult. The Palestinians sort of try to rule by Arab consensus, and there really is no such thing. There's a lot more quibbling and arguing among Arabs that would make things very, very difficult for peace to be struck.
So you would say it was approximately in 1967 when the Palestinian nationalism began?
Well, I would say that beginning in 1967, this was the first time that the Israelis dangled the West Bank and Gaza Strip as sort of territories that would be joined, that would be somehow connected through, let's say, a road or a bridge or a tunnel, that would essentially mean that there was a contiguous Palestinian state. This was the first time that it was even on the table, and it was the Israelis that offered it. Before that, like I said, you know, the Palestinian nationalist movement was sort of a wreck because these territories were under the control of the Arab states. I think one other thing that's probably worth pointing out is the 1967 war that Egypt and Syria and Jordan lost. This was a devastating loss to the Arab world. It was, believed that the Arab world would be able to gang up on Israel and inflict a lot of damage. Instead, Israel launched a blitzkrieg preemptive operation that essentially destroyed all the air forces and armies of these Arab states. And it was at this point that the Palestinians said, you know what, I think we should do this ourselves. We don't need the help of the Arab world anymore. So this was really the awakening of the Palestinian movement for sure.
An iconic figure of the modern Palestinian movement was Yasser Arafat. What central role did he play in making the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Fatah the leading voice of the Palestinians?
Sure. Well, Arafat and a couple of his colleagues started Fatah in the 1950s when they were living in Kuwait. And it was a small organization that really had no clout whatsoever. It grew throughout the late 1950s and early 1960s, and they launched attacks against Israel from Jordan and from Lebanon and from Syria. And the idea was that it planted this sort of seed in the heads of Palestinians and those in the Arab world that there was an awakening movement, an irregular army that was fighting for the Palestinian cause. And by 1967, and I should also add, by the way, that these attacks contributed, at least in small part, to the tensions leading up to the 1967 war. After the dust settled, after the 1967 war, and Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, was largely discredited and shamed by this military loss, the only figure to really emerge as a winner, let's say, from the Arab cause was Yasser Arafat. This was a man who walked around in fatigues all the time, had a holster and a gun at his side. He had a black and white checkered keffiyeh, a headscarf, which is the Palestinian national symbol, and he always had a two-day-old scruff he was trying to convey that he was working around the clock to fight for the Palestinian cause. So after the 1967 war, he was the only one that hadn't really lost. And at that point, he was appointed head of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. And beginning at that point, this is really when the word Palestinian became synonymous with terrorism. And this is something that the Palestinians have had to struggle with ever since. Yasser Arafat launched a wave of brutal terrorism against Israeli and Jewish targets around the world, I think bringing the Palestinian plight into the consciousness of the world, but also discrediting it with the amount of violence that was associated with it.
Jonathan, we've heard a lot about Obama's funding of Palestinians. It's part of this, I think, the stimulus plan. And this is a lot of controversy that people are saying no as to what's happening. Can you clarify us on exactly what that money went to and how much and for what?
Well, as I understand it, has not been allocated yet. There is, in the aftermath of Operation Cast Lead, which was the war that took place between Hamas and Israel in December 2008 and January 2009, there has been a lot of damage left in the wake of that war. And it's all taken place inside the Gaza Strip. The West Bank, which was under the control of the Fatah organization, is completely intact. The Israelis did not even step foot into the West Bank. The war took place in the Gaza Strip where Hamas is in control, and that area has been devastated. The Israelis essentially operated at will there and destroyed a lot of Hamas's infrastructure. So a lot of the Gaza Strip needs to be rebuilt. And then on top of that, the Obama administration wants to help continue to build the West Bank because the West Bank is under the control of Fatah, which is at least viewed in this administration's eyes as a more moderate faction that the United States can work with. So what we've seen is an allocation of $800 to $900 million, according to who you talk to, and $300 million of that is supposed to go to the Gaza Strip. for rebuilding. There is now a lot of controversy over who exactly would administer those funds. Could it go directly to the Hamas government? This would be a slap in the face of U.S. policy dating back to, you know, the time of Richard Nixon, which says, you know, the U.S. does not negotiate with terrorist organizations, let alone fund them. You know, I mean, here we
Let's
are.
Let's hope not.
The U.S. Treasury Department, where I used to work, we would work around the clock to make sure that funds would not go to the Hamas organization. And then here we've got the potential of transferring $300 million to Hamas for rebuilding. So that's a huge problem, and that's really been on a lot of people's radar. The other alternative would be to provide those funds to the United Nations Relief and Works Association, which is an organization that purports to support Palestinian refugees. The only problem is that this organization essentially continues to perpetuate the problem of the refugees rather than solving it. This organization has worked with Hamas in the past. There have been at least indications of that. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding exactly how this money would be allocated in Gaza, and has a lot of advocates of Israel up in arms, so to speak.
Jonathan, we're going to take a brief pause, if you'll just hold for just a moment.
My pleasure.
From Washington, it's Just the Facts, a daily news program giving you the straight facts about progress, technology, and the environment. Here's David Rothbard.
Everyone knows that organic farming is good for the environment, right? Well, many think so because organics don't use chemical pesticides. But it appears some are beginning to take a second look at organic farming because of its contribution to, you guessed it, global warming. Organic farming, you see, requires more plowing to control weeds than modern high-tech farming, and this tillage of the land increases CO2 emissions significantly. When you also consider that expanding organic farming means there will be a need for a lot more animal manure as fertilizer, and animal manure, of course, comes from greenhouse-emitting cows, you can readily see why not everyone is chomping at the notion of eating all natural.
Just the Facts is a presentation of CFACTS. For more information, visit us on the web at cfacts.org. That's CFACT.org.
You're listening to the Justice Hour on 1340 AM WPBR. I'm your host, Lisa Macy, and joining me today is Jonathan Shanzer, director of the Jewish Policy Center. Now, Jonathan, getting back to Obama's Palestinian funding, does the Jewish Policy Center take a position in that funding?
Well, we take the position, and I think this is really the position of most of the think tanks and advocates of Israel in Washington right now, is that we need to be very careful how the United States allocates those funds. You know, there is even a lot of question about whether the U.S. should be funding the $500 or $600 million that would be going to the West Bank, because most of those funds are going to go to the West Bank Army, the Army of the Palestinian Authority. We did this in the 1990s. We funded a Palestinian army, which in turn turned its guns on Israel during the outbreak of the Intifada in 2000. So there's a concern about that, but I don't think anybody is ready to go to the mattresses, so to speak, over that. The issue really comes down to whether the funds should go to Hamas or even UNRWA directly. And you know, what most people are saying is that, you know, absolutely not. Should these funds go to Hamas directly, and UNRWA really should not go there either. What we need to find is a third party, an organization that can dispense these funds in a legitimate manner, and one that provides very significant oversight.
What about immigration? My understanding is that the Obama administration is supporting immigration from the Middle East. I don't know if it's Palestinian or from other places.
You mean to the United States?
Yes.
This is something that actually has been going around on the internet quite a bit, but is actually not true.
Okay.
There are a lot of rumors that are going around right now about what
right.
the Obama administration is supporting and what it is not. We know that it is supporting this funding of the Palestinian Authority, and that is highly controversial. The notion that there are refugees that are being invited to live here in the United States, to my knowledge, everything that I've been able to find, it is incorrect. A very good website, by the way, to try to figure out whether these things are true or not is Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S. That's really one of the first places that I look when I see proposed legislation that seems so outlandish that it probably couldn't be true, or so angering that, you know, you start to turn red. First check there, and you'll often find that that it's someone who's spreading a rumor.
Hmm. Okay, getting back to the Fatah, let me ask you, how did the Fatah, the Palestinian-specific uprising against the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, change the geopolitics of the problem?
Well, the Intifada, the uprising, or shaking off as it's directly translated in Arabic, this was an uprising that began in 1987. December 1987, when an Israeli military truck rear-ended a flatbed full of Palestinians returning to their homes in the Gaza Strip after a day of work. The funerals quickly turned into demonstrations, and the demonstrations spread across the Gaza Strip and into the West Bank, and all of a sudden there was this sort of organic uprising of Palestinians, you know, claiming that they sought independence from Israeli control over the West Bank and Gaza. This did a couple of things. I mean, number one, up until that point, the Palestinians had largely been losing the public relations battle. It always seemed that they were the terrorists and they were the one who were carrying out violence against Israel. All of a sudden, you know, you had these young kids throwing rocks and using slingshots and burning tires, and it was this sort of, you know, these acts of civil disobedience that captured the attention of the world and really made it seem as if Israel was doing something wrong in controlling these two territories. And so this shifted the balance in that way. It also, I think, influenced some of the other actors in the Arab world. The Jordanians, for instance, relinquished all rights to the West Bank, saying that they sought it to be a Palestinian state whenever that time would come. And eventually, actually, the uprising helped pave the way for the Oslo process. In other words, the world was sort of shocked to see these acts of disobedience taking place throughout the territories, and this jump-started the notion that perhaps there could be peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. And, of course, the Oslo process lasted throughout the 1990s, but again devolved into violence in September and October of 2000.
Now, getting back to the funding, my understanding is in the Middle East that these governments are very, very corrupt, and we've tried to help the people, especially innocent civilians who were victims of war in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the government has taken the money so that even when there have been efforts to go in to try to remedy the situation in the villages or with the civilians, the government has taken the money.
Well, and that is actually the worst case of it that I can think of to date is actually the Palestinians. Throughout the 1990s, throughout the Oslo process, as you know, the Israelis and Palestinians negotiated peace, what we saw consistently was that there was, you know, tens of millions of dollars pouring in from the European Union, from the U.S., from all over the international community, with the intent to prop up the government of the Palestinian Authority under Yasser Arafat.
Okay.
And rather than allowing those funds to trickle down to the people, as you say, what we saw was is that the leadership of the Palestinian Authority, the PLO and the PA, squirreled away these funds, and none of it got down to the people, and the people ended up being very frustrated and very upset with the governance. And essentially, that's one of the reasons why the Hamas organization won the Palestinian legislative elections of January 2006. You know, many people were shocked to find that the Palestinian people, who are, by the way, a very educated people, they spent a lot of time, you know, broadly speaking, many Palestinians have spent a lot of time overseas studying in Western universities, etc. So people were shocked to find that the Palestinians voted for Hamas openly. This was a free and fair election, and Hamas won by a wide margin. And what that comes down to, most Palestinians say they voted for Hamas because they were sick and tired of the corruption of the Palestinian Authority, of Yasser Arafat and his cronies, who stole funds directly that were supposed to go to the Palestinian people, that were supposed to improve the quality of life of the Palestinians, and instead only enriched those people at the very top of the food chain. So, and this is a problem we continue to see in Egypt. We see it Iran doesn't get a lot of international aid, but Afghanistan, you know, there are signs of corruption. But throughout the Arab world, it's safe to say that the leadership continues to take what should be going to the average man on the street.
So isn't it a little shocking that the Obama administration would want to put $800 million into the
shocking Palestinian
conflict?
But, you know, one has to understand the context.
They already know that there's corruption. Very little of the money that is sent there, this is U.S. money, is ever going to reach the goal of its intended effect.
Right. Well, you know, the logic here, and you know, we can certainly argue with the logic, but the logic is that since the collapse of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, the U.S. has been seeking to prop up the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank because, you know, the way the U.S. looks at it is they need an alternative to the Hamas organization, which controls the Gaza Strip. So they're putting all their eggs in one basket, and that is the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. So the funds are going to prop up a military that would not collapse the way that the military collapsed in Gaza when Hamas took over. So that's sort of priority one. And then on top of that, you know, they've been inspired to have some confidence in the two leaders of the Palestinian Authority right now. One is Mahmoud Abbas, who was always the number two to Yasser Arafat, who I think is a corrupt bureaucrat. But the other guy who may have at least a little bit of promise, and that is Salam Fayyad. He is a former International Monetary Fund employee, a guy who has really staked his entire career on fighting corruption. The problem is that these are only two men within a structure that is ossified, that is corrupt, and that has been wasting international donor funds for years. So as much as these people may try to turn things around, I believe the cards are stacked against them.
Jonathan, how and when did Hamas evolve into the theocratic rival of Fatah?
Well, you know, this is essentially what I wrote my entire book about.
Right.
Sort of on one foot, the way to describe it is that when the Intifada broke out in 1987, Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization tried to maintain control of it. At the same time, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood was formed called Hamas. Hamas began to challenge Fatah openly on the streets. You know, Fatah would drop these leaflets telling people, here's where to burn tires and here's where to engage in civil disobedience, etc. Hamas did the same exact thing, but with more of an Islamist flavor to it. And so they became political rivals in the late 1980s. When Arafat created the Palestinian Authority and began to negotiate with Israel in the 1990s, Hamas stood firmly opposed to it. And so while the Fatah organization engaged in peace talks with Israel, Hamas, as we all know, was engaging in suicide bombings and these brutal, bloody attacks that took place throughout the state of Israel. What most people believed was happening was that Hamas was simply opposed to Israel. But really, those suicide bombings had two messages. One was, yes, they're opposed to Israel and wanted to kill as many Israelis and Jews as they possibly could, but at the same time, what they were also doing was sending in a message that said, we don't believe what Fatah is doing is correct. We don't believe in peace with Israel, and we challenge Fatah itself. And this happened throughout the 1990s, and really by the late 1990s, nobody saw this. But there were actually attacks that were taking place not against Israel, but Fatah and Hamas were beginning to fight each other openly in the streets. After the Intifada, the second Intifada of 2000, the outbreak of violence in the fall of 2000, they began to fight each other even more as chaos sort of engulfed the Palestinian territories. And then when Yasser Arafat died in 2004, it really appeared as if he alone had been holding these two territories together. Fatah and Hamas began to control different pockets of each territory in the West Bank and Gaza. Different clans and families who were bought and paid for by either Hamas or Fatah controlled these territories, and they were in open competition with each other. And then finally, we had the elections of 2006 that Hamas won, and then the coup that Hamas carried out inside the Gaza Strip, where they actually conquered a territory about the size of Washington, D.C., about 1.5 million people, is now under the control of Hamas. And you could actually argue that really since late 1987, early 1988, Hamas has always had this goal in mind of trying to, you know, gain control of the Palestinian territories, or in this case, one of the territories, and to make it more of an Islamist polity that sees itself in complete opposition to the secular Fatah organization or the Palestinian Authority.
And what was Sheikh Yassin's role in growing the organization?
Sheikh Yassin was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1970s, and in the early 1970s, he created an organization called Al-Mujama Al-Islami, which was an organization that it was largely just devoted to building mosques and food shelters and other sort of service organizations for Muslims in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. What was interesting is that during the 1970s, as Israel was getting very worried about the violence that was being carried out by the Fatah organization under Yasser Arafat, the Israelis decided to support Yassin's work. And this is a classic case of what we call blowback, and it's sort of like what the United States did in Afghanistan in the 1980s. We supported the Mujahideen, the fighters against the Soviets, and they ended up coming back to fight the United States. This happened to Israel in the 1970s and 1980s. They supported Yassin's work, and Yassin in the late 1980s went on to found the Hamas organization, and Hamas already had all of these mosques and food shelters and nursery schools and everything else. They had this network that they were able to use to garner more popularity, and this is essentially how Hamas experienced the meteoric rise that it did during the late 1980s and early 1990s.
What are the effects of both Fatah and Hamas from the politics and actions of outside influences, including the Muslim Brotherhood and Iranian?
Right, it's a great question. What's interesting is that Hamas is a splinter organization of the Muslim Brotherhood. So one would expect it to be more of a Muslim Brotherhood state right now inside the Gaza Strip. But what we're seeing is that it's been bought and paid for by Iran. I mean, Iran really sees Hamas as its own little proxy, the way that it does with Hezbollah. But the irony here is that, the Palestinians are 98% Sunni Muslims. So how does this make sense? Iran has been funding Hamas since its inception. Beginning in the 1990s, Hamas would take trips to Sudan, which was also under the control of Iran, and received training and funding and all sorts of things. So over time, Iran has steadily gained control over the Hamas organization. And I would say actually one of the pivotal moments for this relationship was in 2004. If you recall, the Saudi kingdom was experiencing a great deal of homegrown terrorism. Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, as it was called, was carrying out a series of deadly attacks against the Saudi kingdom. The Saudis at that point decided they no longer sought to fund organizations like Hamas and Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades or some of the other terrorist groups in the region. They determined that it was really not in their interest because, they couldn't control the Islamist violence that was taking place in their own territories. So when they did that, Iran pounced on the opportunity and began to fill the void left by Saudi Arabia. So it is the case now that Hamas and the Gaza Strip territory that it controls is really now under Iranian influence more than anything else. Hmm. And meanwhile, you've got the so-called moderate Sunni states, and I say moderate in quotes because they include states like Saudi Arabia, but also Egypt and others, that are seeking to balance the Islamist state in the Gaza Strip under Hamas control by trying to bolster the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. So we actually see right now a microcosm of the larger conflict between Islamism and secularism in the Middle East. We're seeing it play out on a small scale between the West Bank under the secular Fatah organization and the Gaza Strip under the Islamist Hamas group.
How about secular influences? What type of secular influences on both Fatah and Hamas, including Baathist model of Syria and the militias of Lebanon? What effects have they had?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, the Fatah organization is essentially, it's a secular organization, although one has to also say, sort of, you have to put an asterisk there, that there are factions that are Islamist that have been influenced by Iran and by the Saudis. And I mentioned this group before, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. This is a splinter of the Hamas organization. It is actually, or of the Fatah organization. It is crafted in the image of Hamas. I mean, this is the way that Fatah tries to compete with the Hamas organization through the maintenance of this Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. And you might remember the Karine A incident, where the Israelis captured a ship with 50 tons of weapons destined for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade during the violence of the Intifada in the early part of this decade. And those weapons were shipped to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade directly from Hezbollah on the orders of Iran. So there is definitely an Islamist influence on a secular Fatah group. Now, on the other hand, you look at the Hamas organization, and yes, it is definitely influenced by Baathists. The Syrians have a modicum of control. I mean, we're not looking at a huge amount, but there are offices, Hamas offices, that are in Syria, and Syria plays a role in the training and the financing and the shipping of weapons to Hamas. And the Syrians are not an Islamist. It's not an Islamist state. It's not an Islamist leadership. So one has to sort of wonder, what exactly are they doing? Are they trying to, you know, maybe instill a Ba'athist influence in Hamas? My argument to that is that it probably is not the case. They are just simply using Hamas as a tool. Syria uses Islamist groups, violent groups, as a weapon against either Israel or against Lebanon. This is how they maintain power. Their enemies know that Syria can order attacks or make things very difficult for their enemies, and this is something that Syria continues to use in its hip pocket.
Jonathan, we're going to take another brief pause, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Lisa Macy,
Sarah Macy,
and Ginger Macy.
Some confuse power with goodness and mistake law for justice,
but not our mom.
Listen to the Justice Hour, Mondays 9 through 10 a.m. on WPVR,
where you're a star.
Hi, this is Governor Charlie Crist. Hello to all the listeners in Palm Beach County and the Justice Hour listeners today. Thank you so much. Good to see you.
In America, there are those who make the law and those who make it look good.
Welcome back to the Justice Hour with Jonathan Schanzer from Washington, D.C., and author of Hamas vs. Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. I'm your host, Lisa Marie Macy, and we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 561-533-6134 if you have a question or a comment for Jonathan Schanzer. Now, Jonathan, is there any influence that the Palestinian Christian minority plays in this political dynamic, as there were recently approximately 10% of the Palestinian population, and who do they support?
Well, I actually have just written a little piece about this for the Hudson Institute. The Christian population has been suffering in Gaza since the Hamas takeover in 07, in June of 07.
I would imagine.
Since that point, and this is a community that has lived in Gaza for thousands of years, and you know, has always sought to integrate with the Muslim population there and to get along, and they always have. But what we're seeing is this implementation of Islamist law to a certain extent. I mean, it's not official, but there are, you know, Islamic courts now that are sponsored by Hamas. The justice system is essentially falling apart. But even more worrisome for the Christian community right now is the fact that there are vigilante groups that are patrolling the areas, making sure that people are dressed modestly or they're not holding hands, or that couples that walk together have to be married if they're going to be seen in public. And on top of that, there's actually been some worse stories of churches and schools, Christian churches and schools, that have been raided by the Hamas organization. They've been hit with grenades. They've had books burned, crosses and Bibles destroyed. So what we're seeing is a systematic violation of the rights of Christians in the Gaza Strip, and it's resulting, unfortunately, in a brain drain. The Christians, you know, have always sought to live there. There's, you know, again, there's a real tradition of living there, but people are beginning to feel that there's really not much of a future for them there. So there's the sense that it's time to get out while they still can. So the Christian population is suffering, and there are a number of Christian organizations and newspapers and wire services that have been reporting on this regularly, and it's gotten a lot of people very upset. And you know, this is really a great cause for concern, given the fact that we are really watching, and it's not just Christians, I should add, we're watching the Talibanization of the Gaza Strip. Since it's come under Hamas control almost 2 years ago, it, you know, the vigilante attacks have continued, and not just against Christians, but also against you know, political foes of Hamas, the Fatah members who have remained, even if they're not engaging in violence with Hamas, have been targeted. People have been kidnapped off the streets. There has been no due process. People are returned after months without hair on their heads, have their mustaches shaved, or worse, will have their legs broken. During the fighting, people were pushed off of tall buildings and had their legs or arms shot at point blank to ensure permanent disabilities. What we're seeing is a systematic violation of human rights on the part of Hamas, to the point that people are calling it Hamastan, that really this does seem like a Taliban-style state. And the worst part about it is, because the main focus has always been the Arab-Israeli conflict, the conflict between Jews and Muslims in the region, people are largely ignoring these problems. So what you have right now are Palestinians killing one another, and it's being ignored because the larger Palestinian conflict seems to overshadow everything.
And what role does the schism play between majority Sunni Islam and the Shiite minority in the calculus for the struggle for Palestine?
Well, there really isn't much of one because, you know, the Shiites are, I think, even less than 0.5%, if there are any, in the Palestinian territories. I mean, this is a Muslim area with a Christian minority. But what we're looking at here is the influence of Iran that continues to dominate the politics of the Gaza Strip. And like I said, we're really, in addition to that schism that we're seeing, this microcosm of the secular Islamist divide between the West Bank and Gaza, we're seeing the influence of the Shiites on the Gaza Strip and the Sunnis in the West Bank. And again, it's that microcosm of a larger conflict that's taking place throughout the Middle East.
What do you think the chances are for reconciliation between the two Palestinian factions?
I don't have a lot of confidence at this point. This is not to say that we won't see reconciliation later on down the line, but what we've seen is since the close of Operation Cast Lead in January of 2009, the Arab world, with the leadership of the Egyptians, have tried to bring together the Palestinian factions, I think, four times now, where they've tried to hold these talks. They've done it in some cases where, you know, it's all talked about in the open. There are other times where it's been done sort of more quietly with smaller committees that try to hammer out individual problems. But each time they have failed. We've got another round of negotiations coming up in the middle of May. On May 16th, I think, is the next round of talks that are due to take place in Cairo. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that you've got two factions who do not want to relinquish control of the territories that they now inhabit. The idea of the Fatah organization or the Palestinian Authority relinquishing control when the United Nations, the U.S. and the EU, and really most of the Sunni world does not want it to give up power. We know that that's not going to happen. And then in the Gaza Strip, you've got Hamas, and you know, it should be the goal of the international community to get Hamas to relinquish this territory. But you know, you have to remember that this is now an area that is de facto controlled by Iran. Iran sees this as a pawn on the chessboard. I mean, it's got control of a pawn in southern Lebanon. It's got one in Syria. It's got one in Sudan. It is, you know, it sees this area as one more power pocket.
Right.
And the idea of Hamas just simply coughing up this territory is anathema to the Iranian strategy. So, you know, my sense is that we're going to be caught in this conflict for a little while. The main thing that I talk about this in the last chapter of my book is, you know, we need to see some third parties emerge within the Palestinian people. We need to see some people who say, we would like to assume leadership of both territories. We deserve to do it. We are, you know, we're providing an alternative that maybe provides some sort of a middle ground between Hamas and Fatah. The problem, though, is that, you know, a middle ground that even includes some of Hamas's ideology means continued conflict. I mean,
right.
Hamas exists only to destroy the state of Israel. So, you know, again, we find ourselves in a quagmire. And again, I believe that this is a conflict that is so overlooked by the international community. We're so concerned, and when I say we, I mean the U.S. administration, the international community, so concerned with solving the Arab-Israeli conflict, we've forgotten that there is a conflict that needs to be solved first in order to even get back to the negotiating table. And, you know, I can only say it so many times that we need to wake up to this reality or we're going to find ourselves in an even more intractable position, which is hard to imagine.
Now, since the Hamas Charter calls for the destruction of Israel and the Fatah Charter was changed from having text that indicated that was the objective of the PLO, what's the practical difference between the two, and does it really matter who the Israelis deal with and why?
You have asked a wonderful question, and you know, again, this is one that we could probably spend a half hour talking about, but there is really no difference per se between Hamas and Fatah. Fatah's charter actually still calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. If you Google Fatah charter, you will find that. The PLO did change its charter upon the prodding of the Clinton administration during the Oslo process. So the PLO, which is the larger umbrella organization of the Palestinian people, accepts in principle the state of Israel and does not call for its destruction. The party that makes up the majority of the PLO, which is Fatah, still calls for Israel's destruction. And then, on you know, if you look at the Hamas charter, again, it's available online in English, you will see that it also calls for the destruction of the State of Israel through a jihad. They actually say that it is the duty of every Muslim to wage jihad to liberate Palestine, as they say. So, you know, we're looking at, in principle, you know, what is written and what is, you know, prescribed through their charters. They're really one and the same. The difference is the way that they behave. The Hamas organization is, you know, steadfastly opposed to even having a modicum of peace with Israel. You know, we see the Hamas organization was dedicated to thwarting the peace process through suicide bombings, and now today we see the indiscriminate firing of rockets into southern Israel, and this is all coming out of Hamas territory. On the other hand, you've got Fatah, which seems to be at least open to discussions with Israel, and is what a lot of people would say is that the Fatah organization seeks Israel's destruction in the long term, and Hamas seeks Israel's destruction in the short term. This is not to say that Fatah won't one day come around and maybe amend its own charter. But until it does, I wouldn't trust it further than I could throw it.
We're running out of time. And then my last question to you, Jonathan, is there ever going to be peace? I know you can't really answer this question, but are we ever going to see peace between Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, you know, I still think it's possible. You know, the first thing that I would say that we need to do is we need to find someone who speaks for the Palestinians. This is the first step. You know, unfortunately, you know, it's just gotten to a place where it's more complex, and now we need to understand who speaks for the Palestinians first, and we've got to make sure that whoever does speak for the Palestinians is that next Mahatma Gandhi or Nelson Mandela. I mean, somebody who envisions a moderate Palestinian state. But even beyond that, and I talk about this in the last chapter of my book, is, you know, we need to see ideologies formed within the Palestinian Authority that call for the creation of something rather than the destruction of something. Both Hamas and Fatah, as we just talked about, call for the destruction of the State of Israel.
Jonathan, I'm going to take a quick call from Susan.
Sure.
Good morning, Susan, and welcome to the Justice Hour.
Yes. Well, I'm just getting in here, so this may be totally off base here. This is Sue Glasgow, and you know, I understand that Mr. Schanzer is, you know, talking more only about terrorism, or is he talking about more general legal issues?
No, he's talking about the Palestinian conflict in Israel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, my question probably doesn't have anything to do with him, except I was just wondering, you know, from the United States point of view, and one of the things that really bothers me about the legal system is judicial discretion, and I was wondering if our leadership role was somewhat impaired by the fact that we don't set the example sometimes that we should because of, you know, a judge can kind of rule or overrule anything they want just by their discretion. I mean, part of I think why we have some of our difficulties is because we don't set a good enough leadership role. We talk out of both sides of our mouths sometimes.
Thanks for calling, Susan. I'll have Jonathan answer your question.
Okay. Yeah. If he could give me an email, I'd like to send him that World Jewish Foundation letter that I sent you a couple months ago.
Okay. That would be great. Jonathan, why don't we give out your website and contact information now so Susan can write it down. Susan's in Connecticut.
Our website at the Jewish Policy Center is www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And you also can find my own collection of writing on the web at shanzer.pundicity.com, PUNDICITY.com. And you're able to reach me. You can email me through both websites.
And Jonathan, did you want to make any comments about Susan's
I'm not a lawyer, so I would probably leave that to you since you are
okay.
The host of the Justice Hour.
Now, what should a concerned citizen do to learn more about this issue?
Well, you know, I've written a book about this, and I encourage people, you know, interested in learning more about the Palestinian conflict to read the book. And then, you know, I think beyond that, you know, I think it's important to let our leadership know, our members of Congress and you know, or even our local leaders, that, you know, we're not opposed to seeing continued negotiations between the Palestinians and Israelis. As a matter of fact, we want to see that, but that we need to see this first step take place first. We need to see the Palestinians come together and figure out who speaks for them before we take those next steps and try to exact you know, concessions from both sides. If we try to get those concessions first, before we know who speaks for the Palestinians, this is a prescription for more bloodshed, which is exactly what we're trying to avoid. I mean, if we're working towards peace, let's make sure we know who is trying to negotiate peace on the Palestinian side first.
And I want to thank you again, Jonathan, for all the great work you're doing. And your book is available on which website?
You can get it on Amazon.com, or if you go to JewishPolicyCenter.org, you can click on the ad and buy it through there as well.
Excellent. Thank you again for joining us today. We really appreciate your time and expertise.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Some upcoming events.